Today is Monday, April 12th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinodofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden set to discuss $2 trillion infrastructure with Congress.
Biden faces the same choice he had earlier this year with his $1.9 trillion economic recovery package.
Also ahead, UK lifts some COVID restrictions.
Brits rejoiced on Monday as pubs reopened for the first time in months, racing to grab a drink as the clock struck midnight.
Plus, what's responsible for the decline in the number of sea turtles? These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S. Lawmakers return to Washington this week with U.S. President Joe Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure package topping the agenda. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
President Joe Biden will meet with a bipartisan group of lawmakers this week to talk about his infrastructure package to fund improved roads and bridges, faster internet connections, high-speed trains, and much more. Biden faces the same choice he had earlier this year with his $1.9 trillion economic recovery package. Negotiate what's in the infrastructure package and how to pay for it with Republicans, or go forward with the legislation with only Democrats' support. While the Senate is divided 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats, Vice President Kamala Harris can break a tie. So far, Biden says he wants to seek bipartisan support. Jennifer Granholm is the U.S. Energy Secretary. She spoke to ABC's this week.
The president is willing to negotiate what this looks like. He knows that his current plan is going to be changed. That's the nature of compromise. So whether it is in one big package or several packages, he wants to talk to Republicans.
Republican leaders have stated their opposition to the package, saying it's too big, and they oppose how Biden proposes to pay for it, raising the corporate tax rate to 28%, up from the current 21%. It would partially reverse tax cuts made by then-President Donald Trump 4 years ago. Republican leaders say they are hoping negotiations with Biden go better than they did over the economic rescue package. Senator Roger Wicker is a Republican from Mississippi. He spoke to ABC this week.
We are willing to negotiate with him on an infrastructure package, and this trillion-dollar number is way too high for me, I'll just tell you. But negotiation has to be something different from what we had on the rescue plan.
The American Society of Civil Engineers gives U.S. infrastructure a C-minus grade in its latest report. The group says years of inaction have left the country with deteriorating roads and bridges, while airports, water supplies, and public transit systems require upgrades. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The Biden administration has said it will not be involved in a national, quote, vaccine passport system, deferring instead to private companies to implement mechanisms for people to prove they have been vaccinated for travel and other activities. White House correspondent Patty Withers-Kuara has this report on why vaccine credentialing is a controversial issue in the U.S.
Excited fans returning to New York's Yankee Stadium earlier this month for the first time since October 2019 as the new Major League Baseball season begins. They have to prove that they are coronavirus free.
Just showing the vaccination card after 14 days is good enough. Otherwise, I know people are getting tested.
This week, New York became the first state to offer a digital vaccine passport, a free app and website to prove COVID-free status either through vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio.
We've got to respect people's privacy. We got to make sure that the system is accurate. There's definitely more to be worked through, but I think they'll be part of the solution.
Private companies around the world already use digital vaccine certification in tourism, entertainment, and other industries. Several countries, including China and Israel, have launched official nationwide systems, but don't expect the U.S. to follow. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
There will be no centralized universal federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential.
Vaccine certification is controversial in the U.S. Some Republican governors have even issued executive orders banning them. Jeffrey Bennett teaches health and communications at Vanderbilt University.
Americans are often very skeptical of the idea of anything that might be centralized in the federal government, and they see that kind of centralization as being an affront to either privacy or to freedom.
The Biden administration is urging private entities to develop their own solutions, but will provide guidelines to meet certain standards, including accessibility and affordability. The World Health Organization is also against the idea of vaccine passports for travel between countries. WHO spokesperson Margaret Harris.
We're not certain that at this stage that the vaccine prevents transmission, and there are all those other questions, apart from the question of discrimination against people who are not able to have the vaccine for one reason or another.
While certification may help industries eager to jumpstart revenue, health experts say ultimately the answer is to simply vaccinate more people. William Schaffner is a professor of health policy at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine.
The more people who are vaccinated, if we really get to over 80%, then we don't have to worry about those vaccine passports.
Currently, about 20% of Americans are fully inoculated. With vaccine hesitancy still a factor, challenges remain for the country to reach herd immunity. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
England's shops, hairdressers, gyms and pub gardens will reopen on Monday in what Prime Minister Boris Johnson said was a, quote, major step, unquote, towards freedom from the restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
4, 3, 2, 1. Ladies and gentlemen, take your seats. Have your first drinks. Please come down.
Brits rejoiced on Monday as pubs reopened for the first time in months, racing to grab a drink as the clock struck midnight.
Well, after 14 months of not going anywhere except funerals, it's a great plus, yeah.
Hairdressers, gyms and other shops are also set to reopen Monday. For now, pubs and restaurants will be restricted to serving outdoors, as dine-in services won't resume until May 17th at the earliest. Non-essential stores like home and fashion chains will reopen in Wales as well as England, although residents of Scotland will need to wait another 2 weeks. Hundreds of thousands of businesses have been shut since early January, when England entered a third national lockdown to curb a more highly contagious local variant of the coronavirus. A speedy vaccination campaign has cut COVID-19 cases by some 90% since peaking in January, and COVID-19 deaths by 95%. That progress will allow the staged easing of lockdown to proceed in what British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called a major step towards freedom. Persuading Brits to reopen their wallets as they return to some kind of normalcy is key to the country's recovery. Official data released last month showed that 2020 was the British economy's worst year in more than three centuries, with UK retailers having lost an estimated £27 billion or $37 billion in sales during lockdowns.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. Despite warnings that no quick breakthrough are expected, both US and Iranian officials are praising indirect talks in Vienna that are aimed at reviving the 2015 international Iran nuclear deal. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has this report.
In Vienna this week, U.S. and Iranian officials stayed in separate hotels, and the two sides met separately with the other signatories of the 2015 agreement on Iran's nuclear program: Great Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China. Both Washington and Tehran described the discussion as constructive. They are the first indirect talks between the United States and Iran since Washington withdrew from the agreement in 2018 under then-President Donald Trump. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said there is no expectation of direct negotiations for now, but that the United States is open to them. When asked about the first major obstacle, that each side wants the other side to move first, Price cited the deployment of U.S. Special Envoy Rob Malley and other top officials to Vienna to work things out diplomatically. He stressed the need for compromise.
It leaves us where we started, really, with the knowledge that maximalist demands probably are not going to get us very far.
The talks are getting a lot of attention in Iran, where citizens are cautious in public, but likely hoping for economic relief from crippling Western sanctions. Diplomats in Vienna have established two working groups, one to work on how Iran can return to compliance on its nuclear program, and the other on which sanctions the U.S. can ease. The Atlantic Council's Barbara Slavin says she thinks President Joe Biden can get the nuclear deal revived.
The Democrats control both houses of Congress. And Donald Trump actually may have done us a favor, because by pulling out of the deal unilaterally while Iran was in compliance with it, he actually made the deal more popular.
The University of Vienna's Heinz Gadna says a 25-year, $400 billion strategic cooperation pact reached between Iran and China late last month may have provided more incentive for all sides to get the Iran nuclear deal back up and running.
That's VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain. Anti-Asian hate crime is on the rise in many parts of the world, including in Vancouver, Canada, the Vancouver Police Department reports. Home to a large population of ethnic Asians, the Western Canadian city has seen a sharp rise in racist attacks coinciding with the COVID-19 pandemic. Craig McCullough reports.
A recently released report from the Vancouver Police Department shows a 717% increase in hate crimes in the city targeting the Asian community, rising from 12 in 2019 to 98 last year. The numbers mirror disturbing trends in the United States and are startling in a diverse city with a large and well-established Asian community. Government statistics show that 42% of the population of metropolitan Vancouver are of Asian descent. Many families have been in Canada for generations, with their ancestors coming around the 1858 gold rush and to work on building the country's first national railway the following decade. Now, well into 2021, those hate crimes are continuing to get headlines. On March 30th, a 47-year-old was charged with the rarely used public incitement of hatred and mischief to property after writing racist graffiti on windows of the Greater Vancouver Chinese Cultural Center. Fred Kwok, chairperson of the center, says the racist vandalism was planned and intentional.
I would say malicious intent to spread xenophobia to general public. And on top of that, actually, I mentioned that to the police. I said, this is almost like, I can compare that to an act of terrorism. That's sole purpose is to put fear in all Chinese.
Queenie Chu is the CEO of Success, a Vancouver-based nonprofit organization that helps new immigrants, predominantly from Asia, in Canada. Chu says there's always been some racism against the Asian community, but politicians in the Western Hemisphere renaming COVID-19 into a Chinese-sounding flu did not help. She's urging more research and documentation on the issue.
One of the ways to do it is to collect of race-based data in consultation with communities and be open about why and what data is collected and how it will be used to make improvements so that we understand the magnitude of the situation.
Chu also says Canadians must confront systemic racism in Canada, adding that government should fund anti-racism campaigns, including educational initiatives. Constable Tanya Vizentine, spokesperson for the Vancouver Police Department, says the increase in race-based attacks in the city is surprising.
It was quite baffling, especially because we're such a multicultural city. So the fact that there was so much hate towards those of East Asian descent in particular was quite upsetting.
Vizentine says the department has made it easier to report hate crimes online. It is hoped more data and documentation will help the city reverse the trend. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
This is the Voice of America. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has blamed Israel for what Tehran says was a sabotage attack that caused a power outage at its underground Natanz nuclear facility. Saeed Khatibzadeh made the comment Monday, warning Iran would take revenge for the attack. Israel has not indicated it was responsible for the outage, though Israeli media almost uniformly say a cyber attack caused it. The Russian court has opened a trial for feminist activist and artist charged with disseminating pornography after she shared artwork depicting female anatomy online, a case in line with the Kremlin's conservative stance promoting, quote, traditional family values, unquote. Yulia Sedkova from the far eastern city of Komsomolsk on Amur faces up to 6 years in prison. Tens of thousands of Hindu devotees gathered by the Ganges River for special prayers, many of them flouting social distancing practices as the coronavirus spreads in India with record speed. The Kumbh Mela, or Pitcher Festival, is one of the most sacred pilgrimages in Hinduism. People who take a dip in the river believe it will absolve them of their sins and deliver them from the circle of birth and death. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 cases and deaths are rising globally, partly because of complacency setting in that vaccines will stop the spread of the disease. The latest WHO report confirms more than 133.5 million cases of coronavirus infections, including nearly 3 million global deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Data show a worrisome uptick in coronavirus cases and deaths in all regions of the world, with Africa slightly less affected than other regions. The World Health Organization attributes this rise to several factors, including an increase in coronavirus variants, failure to practice public health measures, and the resumption of so-called normal life when people emerge from lockdown. Another problem, says WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris, is a growing complacency that the availability of vaccines will soon end the crisis.
People are misunderstanding that, seeming to think that vaccination will stop transmission. That is not the case. We need to bring down the transmission while giving the vaccination the chance to stop the severe disease and the severe deaths.
WHO reports nearly 670 million doses of vaccines have been administered globally. However, most of those doses have been given in wealthy countries. Furthermore, WHO warns there is a critical shortage of vaccines. Harris says some countries cannot start COVID-19 inoculation campaigns because of the serious shortfall of doses, especially in developing countries.
So what can be done about it? Doubling down on the public health social measures, truly understanding we have to keep on social distancing, we have to avoid indoor crowded settings, we have to keep wearing the masks, even if vaccinated.
The good news, says Harris, is preliminary results from countries such as Britain show that vaccination programs have averted very large numbers of deaths. However, until most of the world is vaccinated, she says people must not let down their guard. They must remain vigilant and practice the few simple public health measures that have been shown to work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greece has lashed out at Turkey for alleging that the government in Athens is aiding and abetting Kurdish terrorists. But the accusation contained in the newly released video comes after reports in Greece that Turkey has granted citizenship to Islamic State militants. Antti Karasava reports from Athens that fresh accusations traded by the two NATO allies may threaten ongoing negotiations to ease long-standing differences that nearly sparked a war between them last year. Scientists studying sea turtles say the ancient animal's numbers are dropping. They blame mostly human activity, but they say they hope a new action plan could help the species mount a comeback. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Researchers with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, catch a leatherback sea turtle off the coast of California.
Pull.
The tens of millions of years old species is in serious decline, says ecologist Scott Benson.
Estimates are that the population now is about 1,400 adult females remaining. That's down from literally tens of thousands a few decades ago.
Benson co-authored a new study that says the foraging area used by the leatherback sea turtle saw a population drop of about 80% in the past 30 years. He says this is amazing given the species' adaptability.
The leatherback turtle is an ancient mariner. They've been around for almost as long as 80 million years in their present form, date back to the time of the dinosaurs. It's not a poorly adapted species. They've been through all kinds of things. meteor strikes, climate changes, you name it.
He says the smaller numbers make the species more vulnerable to outside factors like international fishing and egg harvesting. Benson's team puts transmitters on turtles so their fishing fleets can avoid them. He says his team is doing what it can to boost the rapidly dwindling numbers.
We're down to the remnants right now, so any little thing now could potentially disrupt it. So we have just a very little time to turn around.
All seven species of the leatherback are in trouble, but the new study focuses on the Western Pacific variety, which migrates more than 11,000 kilometers from Indonesia and the Solomon Islands to the U.S. West Coast to feast on jellyfish. NOAA recently released a new action plan calling for greater international cooperation. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Marine experts estimate about 400,000 humpback whales are now migrating through Australia waters annually, up from about 1,500 half a century ago. The species has recovered strongly after the end of commercial hunting, and Australia is considering removing humpbacks from its threatened species list. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The humpback's annual journey from Antarctica to subtropical waters along Australia's east and west coasts is one of nature's great migrations. It's a journey of up to 10,000 kilometres, and is undertaken between April and November. Scientists have estimated 40,000 humpback whales have been in Australian waters to mate and breed. It is a remarkable recovery from the height of commercial whaling in the early 1960s, when it was estimated there were fewer than 1,500 humpbacks. They were slaughtered mainly for their oil and baleen, or whale bone. Australia's Environment Department says no other whale species has recovered as strongly as the humpback since the end of commercial hunting, which ceased in Australia in 1978. Australia is now considering removing humpback whales from the threatened species list because of their growing numbers. The acrobatic humpbacks that can grow to 16 metres would still be protected in Australia. Conservationists, though, argue that they need more, not fewer, environmental safeguards to monitor the impact of climate change on krill, their main source of food. Krill are affected by the absorption of more carbon dioxide into the ocean. Olaf Meinecker, a research fellow in marine science at Queensland's Griffith University, says vigilance is needed to ensure the whales continue to thrive.
Generally speaking, yes, it's a great success story that humpback whales have come back. But obviously, we also need to ask questions as how will this continue in the future? How are present threats already impacting the population? And how are we going to detect changes in the future?
Scientists say humpbacks face a combination of other threats, including the over-harvesting of krill, pollution, habitat degradation and entanglement in fishing nets. Calves also face attack by killer whales or sharks. The recovery of the humpback has helped the rapid growth of Australia's whale-watching industry. As their numbers have grown, much about the humpback, a species famous for its song, remains a mystery. Scientists don't know exactly, for example, where on Australia's Great Barrier Reef they mate and calve. Humpback whales live in all the world's oceans. They take their common name from a distinctive hump on the whale's back. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Japan's Prime Minister, on down the country, celebrated golfer Hideki Matsuyama's victory in the Masters tournament in the United States. He's the first Japanese player to win at Augusta National and wear the famous green jacket. Prime Minister Yoshida Suga says, quote, "It was really wonderful. As the coronavirus drags on, his achievements moved our hearts and gave us courage," unquote. Japan is struggling to pull off the postponed Tokyo Olympics in just over 3 months, with coronavirus cases on the rise again in Tokyo and Osaka. The Olympics open on July 23rd. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.